like it might get worse before it gets better. Good morning. I think we're ready, please.
Good morning. If it may please the court, we are here today because the petitioner, Ms. Tiffany Potter, was retaliated against by the Department of Veteran Affairs for engaging in whistleblowing through protected disclosures and engaging in protected OIG activity. When applying the facts of this case to the relevant statutes, case law, and established precedent, the administrative judge's decision in the preceding matter was arbitrary, capricious, an abuse of discretion, or otherwise not in accordance with the law, and or unsupported by substantial evidence.
So there are a lot of moving parts here, and I have some very specific questions, so I'm just going to get to them. I think the government in its brief conceded that there was at least some error in what you call reprisal number two, or I'm calling reprisal number, the cancellation of the chief nurse for advertisement position, in that it was clear that Dr. Deering did know of that. And so that satisfies your knowledge timing test, and it should have switched to be the government's burden. I know they have some arguments on why we can affirm based upon the evidence. I assume your argument is, this one to me seems pretty simple, is that we can't do that fact-finding. That has to go back.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's actually, I believe, one of the central arguments of this case.
Sure. I mean, that one seems pretty clear. I know the government's going to say we don't have to do that, but that's fine. We can talk about
that. On that point, if you're going to move on to the next one,
yep.
What's the relief? Let's assume that's the only thing left standing in this case, and even assuming it goes back to the board and the AJ changes his view, what relief would inure?
So
on that particular allegation.
On that particular allegation, if this court were to find that indeed she met the prima facie case for whistleblower retaliation and the agency could not meet a clear and convincing evidence for that personnel action, then the relief would be she would be paid the higher rate for the chief nurse four position from the time period that it was taken back by the agency, which was in November 2015.
What's the basis for that?
Because the basis is that if the retaliatory act took her out of that position, then they would have to put her in the same.
But
the
she
same
was never
exact...
put in that position in the first place. This is the cancellation of the advertisement for the position.
Well, this is actually the cancellation of the interview process. They advertised the position,
right,
and decided not
but
to.
But how would
it.
She get the pay if she'd never been appointed to it? Wouldn't it just be a reconstruction of whether she could have gotten the position and would have been appointed if the advertisement had gone through?
Well, she was universally considered the most qualified candidate and the individual.
Sure, but don't they have to make that decision before they jump to what you say is back pay?
Well, yes, we believe that they would make that decision.
Okay.
Okay. On I have a couple other very specific things that I'm a little troubled about the way the AJ handled them, but I'm not sure about what's happening here. The August 2024 response by Ms. Potter to the OIG, the AJ found that that wasn't a protected disclosure.
Correct.
So I'm a little confused about this, and maybe you can help me with the record, because did you plead this as a disclosure under B8 to the special counsel or as cooperation with the OIG under B9?
We pled it as under B9, cooperation with the OIG.
But the AJ found it as insufficient because you didn't disclose what you disclosed.
Well, he sort of took both routes. He's
well, I guess, I'm not trying to trick you or anything here. Let me cut to the chase. I don't understand, if you pled it properly under B9, why you have to explain what your disclosure was, because that's a B8 problem. B9 is all you have to show is that you cooperated with the OIG. So why isn't disclosure for, I know these are questions for the government, but I just want to get them out there. Why isn't disclosure for protected activity without detail of what was disclosed?
We believe that's an excellent question, Your Honor.
So my follow-up question to you, though, is does it matter? Because it seems to me that throughout here, there's not been any showing, at least in the relevant timeframes, that the decision makers for these various events specifically knew about her OIG activities.
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
So even if we agree that the AJ erred, or even if I find that the AJ erred in requiring further detail, that just the mere description of OIG cooperation is sufficient, you still have to meet the knowledge part of the knowledge timing test. And what evidence in the record shows that anybody knew about her August 2014 conversations with the OIG, or really any conversations with the OIG?
Well, actually, the record is replete with evidence to show that Dr. Deering and Dr. Venditti had knowledge of her OIG activity. The July 10th, 2014 email showed evidence that she was communicating with the OIG. She also had a meeting with Dr. Deering thereafter, which discussed the specific information she provided to the OIG.
What's the date of that meeting, and is that in the record?
It's in the record. I believe it was after July 10th email. I cannot, July 10th, 2014 email. I cannot give you the specific day of the meeting, but it's definitely in the record that they met and discussed specifically what she provided to the OIG regarding emails and in testimony.
And was that before the dates of all the various alleged reprisals?
That was after the date of the March 2015 change in title, but before the 2015 non-selection and before the January 2017 detailed unclassified duties and before the March 2017 involuntary resignation.
So your view is if the AJ applied the wrong legal standard there and requiring sufficient detail for the disclosure. You said you pled that as a B9 thing in your OSC complaint. Do you have a record site for that?
I do not at this time, but I can get you one on rebuttal.
Okay. The other one, let me move on to another kind of point. I'm talking now about the involuntary resignation, and the AJ said that you didn't establish a prima facie case because this was not involuntary. I don't mean resignation. I mean transfer. That this wasn't a prima facie case because the transfer was voluntary. And I'm a little confused about why the voluntariness of the transfer makes any difference to establishing the prima facie case. Because she had a transfer, which is a protected, which is a covered personnel action under A2. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't say that it's an involuntary transfer. It just says transfer. And assuming you have knowledge of a protected activity, either disclosure or cooperation in time with that transfer, wouldn't that meet the prima facie case?
Yes, it should have met the prima facie.
Let me just make sure I understand. I thought the transfer came at her request. I thought she applied. It was not something that was not an action taken against her.
Well, it was
an inaction.
It was a transfer at her request due to the actions of the agency. She did not want to transfer out of the VA, but because of the agency's actions and the position they put her in, she had no choice. And the case law states Perlman, as well as Guzman, as well as Heining, states that if a transfer is involuntary due to the agency's action in response or in retaliation to the whistleblowing, it becomes a constructive involuntary resignation due
right.
to the statute.
And the AJ looked at that and said, "You would have to show, therefore, that the working conditions were intolerable,
correct,
and that they forced her to leave."
And we believe we had, and we believe we've, yes.
Well, I get that. I'm asking, I think, a slightly different question, and it really ends up who bears the burden of proof on this issue is whether that involuntariness doctrine actually applies to transfers. Because the cases I looked at it was the involuntariness doctrine was basically when somebody resigned or retired, and it therefore, they use that to find it to be an action under Chapter 75, like a removal or something. Whereas here, there's no question that there's an actual personnel action. Mm-hmm. It's a transfer that happened within a certain amount of time under the statute. And so I don't see anything in the plain language of the statute that requires, in order for you to make the prima facie case for the transfer to be involuntary rather than just a transfer. Now, the voluntariness is going to come up, and here's what I'm getting at is whose burden is it and who bears the burden of showing that that transfer wasn't caused by whistleblower or Prisel? Is it your burden initially, or do you just make the prima facie case by having a transfer within a certain time of knowledge, and then the burden shifts to the government to show that the voluntariness of the transfer shows that it wasn't reprisal?
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. Once you meet the prima facie case of
Did you argue that? I mean, this seems to me a fairly nuanced point, and I didn't see you specifically argue that in your blue brief.
I believe it was in the gray brief. What we argued was that with Guzman in a series of events over a span of years, that the involuntary, so we met the prima facie case through A, the December 1st, 2016 OIG disclosure. And then once we met the prima facie case for that, the burden shifted.
Sure.
For the
Okay, so let's stop with that line. The problem I have with this is the same problem you have with reprisal number three, is that the board found that Dr. Nelson or Ms. Nelson had no knowledge of any of these disclosures because she came in after all it happened. Wouldn't that same logic apply to the transfer decision?
That's actually not accurate. The board found that she did not have knowledge of disclosures one, two, and three because she came in after those three disclosures. But she was at the agency for disclosures four and five, which was the December 1st, 2016 OIG disclosure. And I'm sorry, the November.
Well, she might have been there, but did they find that she had specific knowledge of her?
Well,
OIG?
The board found that she did not have specific knowledge.
But that's an evidentiary point, so we can get into that. But wouldn't that same reasoning apply to reprisal four? If she didn't have knowledge for reprisal, for the detail reprisal, alleged reprisal, then wouldn't the similar argument apply to the transfer reprisal?
Well, it would if, again, we believe that Ms. Nelson was not actually the responsible management official that made the decision to detail
to
unclassified.
That's a different argument, though. I want to focus in on Ms. Nelson, and if we find that she was the decision maker and the board's decision that she didn't have knowledge is supported by substantial evidence, then we don't have to reach this tricky issue about involuntary voluntariness on the transfer.
Well, I would disagree that on one point, and I would bring in the case of Guzman, which is for the contributing factor test, you can look at a series of events over a span of years to look at the contributing factor test for a prima facie case. And Ms. Nelson, even though she only had knowledge of the fifth disclosure, Dr. Smith, who was also CC'd on that memo and who we argue was the actual person, the decision personnel individual that was responsible for the unclassified duties, had been at the agency over this time frame and was knowledgeable of all of the protected disclosures that we put forward. And if there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time
for
rebuttal.
Sure, yes.
May it please the court. Ms. Potter sought a promotion from the position of nurse.
Do you want to start with the one you confessed error on and suggested that Dr. Deering did have knowledge and explain why you think we can affirm based upon alternative grounds? Because it seems to me you're requiring us to make factual findings on the record based upon a standard that the board didn't do.
No, Your Honor. We our understanding is that the court may affirm, as it discussed in McCarthy v. MSPB, MSPB's decision on grounds other than those relied on when the MSPB rendered its decision, when upholding that decision does not depend on making a determination of fact not previously made by the MSPB.
Yeah, what the MSPB found was she didn't meet her burden to show certain factors under the Rumsey analysis, and you're asking us to transfer that to your burden under Carr, which is not only a different switch of parties, and one party can fail to meet their burden, and it doesn't mean that the other side necessarily wins. It's like summary judgment. You both could lose. But you have an even higher burden under Carr, so I don't understand how we can affirm this. This one seems like it has to go back for a determination of whether the government can show that it would have taken that action even with the prima facie case on that disclosure.
Your Honor, we disagree because we are looking only at the facts found by the MSPB, not a consideration of the burdens and the specific Rumsey factors. The facts that the MSPB found to apply in the Rumsey considerations were that the agency's reasons. That didn't require a consideration of burden. The MSPB simply looked at the reason that Dr. Deering did not select.
Again, the problem with that is even if we accept all those as factual findings, those were factual findings made to determine that she hadn't made her burden. You're asking us to determine for the first instance whether those factual findings would support a much higher clear and convincing evidence burden. And I don't understand how that's an evidentiary determination we can make.
The specific, there is no, in this case, we don't believe that, we believe that McCarthy explains that this can be done in this situation.
But McCarthy and Comiskey, both of which you cite, had the court deciding on appeal here a question of law where there were no undisputed facts. You're asking us to decide a question of fact. I mean, because what you're asking us to decide, which the agency never did, is whether you established by clear and convincing evidence that you would have taken the same action. That's a fact question. And that seems to me to be a really big distinction between McCarthy and Comiskey in this case.
Well, Your Honor, we think that that the administrative judge did make findings of fact that can be put into the court's consideration.
You think that the administrative judge made findings of fact from which we could find a fact?
No, not that you can find a fact. Simply that you could determine whether whether the MSPB's decision finding the corrective action is not warranted is supported.
No, but we have to. What has to be determined is whether there's clear and convincing evidence that you would have taken the same action regardless of Ms. Potter's whistleblowing. Clear and convincing evidence that you would have taken the same action. I don't see that fact finding anywhere in the lower tribunal's decision.
Well, Your Honor is correct that the MSPB considered the facts in Rumsey under preponderant evidence. That's
but isn't correct. The decision whether the agency would have taken that action a factual question? And the AJ didn't make that decision.
Whether the agency would have taken
have taken the same action absent the protected activity. That's a factual question, isn't it?
It is a factual question, but I think the question here is
I mean, the gist of it is, and I don't want to beat a dead horse, is you're saying, sure, there's a lot of underlying factual things that we could then use to make that ultimate factual determination. That's still a factual determination that the board did not make. It did not make an alternative. If the board had made an alternative finding here saying, well, no prima facie case, but even if there was, the agency has shown, then sure, you might be there. But there is no finding by the board that the agency would have shown by clear and convincing evidence that it would have taken the action. Is there?
I don't believe so.
Can you address, before we move on from this, the remedy? Because I'm a little confused, too, as to what's going to happen here.
Well, in this case, the remedy, I think, as Your Honor mentioned, a potential reconstruction of whether Ms. Potter would have been awarded that position.
Well, and that reconstruction only takes place if the MSPB then does the fact finding and concludes that the government can't prove by clear and convincing evidence, right?
That's correct.
So there's still that whole hurdle. We're not getting to remedy because the lower tribunal hasn't decided liability first.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, but then if they do, you think they reconstruct the process the remedy would be?
I'm not certain, Your Honor, what the way that the MSPB would consider the remedy in this case. It's interesting that Ms. Potter has claimed that what she is entitled to is back pay retroactive to April 2012, 2 years prior to her first alleged whistleblowing activity. And what she's seeking is basically a promotion from nurse 3 to nurse 4, despite the fact that the nursing service had determined that her position in purchased care lacked the complexity required for such an upgrade. There was also required a consideration by the nursing board as to whether that position had the required complexity to be elevated to nurse.
But all that
four.
Goes to remedy, right?
Correct.
And we would, you don't need to argue that to us because we aren't deciding that.
Correct, Your Honor. These are things that also yeah. would come into the consideration. In fact, there's a discussion by the by the administrative judge of the fact that that Mr. Grippen and Dr. Deering had discussed the fact that there were questions about who even if they were trying to create a nurse for a position, how that reporting relationship would be structured, because a nurse was generally reporting to a doctor, and in this case, they would be equivalent. And so there was discussion about the reporting lines, and that is Dr. Deering's explanation as to why he canceled the vacancy. And so those are things that the administrative judge would consider again.
Can I move you on to the disclosure or the August 20th, 2014 response to OIG that the AJ found not to be protected or not established? First, do you agree that they pled this as a B9 to the OSC? Do you know?
Your Honor, I've really taken a look at the OSC complaint. I don't see any specific 9 or 8 mentioned.
Well,
in
if they
the
didn't
OSC.
Do it, do they have to do it specifically as B8, 9, or is it just this is something we did that qualifies as protected activity?
I think it would certainly be helpful to have explained that. The OSC complaint is at Appendix 432. And the administrative judge did, though, cite section.
No, I understand that the administrative judge cited B9, but that's the problem is that he then cited B9 and said it was insufficient because it didn't have sufficient detail. And I don't see what detail is required for B9 protected activity. It's just cooperation, the detail requirement. And some of this may be because these requirements are relatively new. The B9 stuff just came into effect in, I think, 2013. And so there isn't a lot of board precedent. But why would you require details of the disclosure to OIG when they're what they're saying is a prima facie case of retaliation is just based upon the cooperation prong of B9, not the specific contents, which would be covered by B8.
There is no description of cooperation. There is only a statement that Ms. Young reached out to Ms. Potter and said, call me. That doesn't show any cooperation. As we argued, cooperation would require some back and forth and something from Ms. Potter. But Ms. Potter did not include in her her OSC complaint any specific discussion of cooperation. And
the August 20th 2014 response is not something from Ms. Potter back to OIG?
No, it's not. It's an email where Ms. Young writes to Ms. Potter, call me. And that's the sum total of the email. And there is nothing further specifically described by Ms. Potter in her OSC complaint as to anything that followed that. And that's also what the administrative judge found, that there was no evidence of anything further. So for that reason, Ms. Potter has not demonstrated cooperation as required to show a prima facie case. And in addition,
that email itself doesn't. I mean, so reaching out by the OIG doesn't show cooperation by the employee.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
And we'd like to point out also that even if Ms. Potter was correct, that was sufficient to be cooperation, the MSPB also concluded that this wasn't a contributing factor because there was a lack of knowledge. Ms. Potter doesn't refute that. He noted that even if he had found a protected disclosure in that in her receipt of that email from OIG or some specific subsequent interaction that she had with OIG, the appellant did not show that anyone knew about either that email to OIG or any subsequent cooperation. with regard to the duties change, Ms. Potter doesn't explain why the MSPB erred in explaining the agency's reasons and motives. Dr. Vendetti explained that Ms. Potter's title was only changed because the deputy nurse executive explained that the title reserved for nurse fours, it was confusing that it was being applied to a nurse three. In addition,
this is the one instance where the AJ found the prima facie case established but found you rebutted successfully under the clear and convincing standard.
That's correct.
And that's a substantial evidence thing for us.
Correct. For example, part of the agency's reasons are that Mr. Grippen was reorganizing the administrative medicine service at the time, restructuring the leadership team, and that resulted in the creation of two nurse manager positions. And there's testimony from Drs. Deering and Venditti that Ms. Potter requested that division of labor and wanted the workload to be reduced. So Ms. Potter's claim that she had leadership roles removed appears to have been from her own request. And as for transfer to another VA facility, Ms. Potter requested that transfer, and she began looking for other employment opportunities in late 2016, yet the personnel, the action that she says led her to look for other opportunities occurred in January 2017. So she was already looking for another job before the detail. And in fact, that detail was a beneficial thing.
On that point, I mean, does the finding that Ms. Nelson had no knowledge of any of her protected activity with regard to the detail also apply, in your view, to the transfer, even if it was a protected or what would constitute a personnel action?
Yes, Your Honor.
There's nothing between January and March that suggests that Ms. Nelson learned of her protected activities?
No, not that we're aware of. And also the December 2016 complaint, which is the only other action that's within a period, the two-year period that the MSPB has recognized to fit within a knowledge timing test. There's no argument from Ms. Potter that anyone learned of her December 2016 complaint, which Ms. Potter did not include in the record before the MSPB. As for the January 17th, 2017 detail, Ms. Potter was recognized as being a subject matter expert and having a great skill set. And this was the reason that the agency put her into a position where she could provide guidance to Ms. Nelson, provide reports that they had concluded that Dr. Duarte was not doing a good job providing. And Ms. Potter was put into a more elevated position to provide that information to Ms. Nelson. Ms. Potter has not explained why that detail was in some way a demotion or retaliation. And when Ms. Potter claims that Dr. Smith and Mr. Bransky were aware and of her whistleblowing activities and had pushed Ms. Nelson to take this step, the MSPB concluded that Ms. Potter had adduced no evidence that Bransky or Smith had any knowledge of her disclosures. So for that reason, the knowledge timing test can't be met at that point. And since I have run out of time, if Your Honors have no further questions, we request that the court affirm the decision of the administrative judge. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to go through a couple of points really quickly since I'm on limited time. The first point is that the Chenery Doctrine does not state that this court cannot come to an opinion on whether once a prima facie case was met, that a clear and convincing evidence burden was not met by the agency. What the Chenery Doctrine just simply states that this court cannot affirm the lower court's decision, but you can come to a decision, and we would hope that the evidence is...
So you want us to not remand that to the AJ, but we should decide it here?
No, I believe that it has to be remanded, but it can be remanded with the precepts of the opinion of this court. This court
you want
can
us to tell the AJ what to do?
This court can determine that based on...
I think you're asking for a little bit more than you're going to get, and probably unwisely so.
Understood. Secondly, I'd like to argue that the And for the non-selection, the agency provides, the respondent argues that Dr. Deering's email to Human Resources concerning the non-selection provides a compelling reason for the non-selection. However, compelling is not the standard of proof in this case. The DVA must show by clear and convincing evidence that they would have taken the personnel action despite Ms. Potter's whistleblowing activities. The DVA didn't provide any corroborating evidence, such as any emails between Dr. Deering and Nursing Services regarding whom the position will report to, any meeting notes from subsequent meetings regarding the supposed dilemma, nor any copies of reworded functional statement or resubmissions to VISN regarding the reclassification of the position. All they provided was his simple statement that it needed reorganization. This is analogous to what the court stated in Whitmore when it said it is entirely appropriate that the DVA bear a heavy burden to justify its actions, which it has failed to do so in this case. Finally, it is without dispute that from early 2014, the respondent was making concerted efforts to have the chief nurse war position classified through VISN. Ms. Potter herself drafted the functional statement that was used to get the position classified. However, that all changed after the effects of the January 2015 OIG report became known and began reverberating through the agency, causing employment issues for the management involved. Then, without justification, they canceled the chief nurse four position, and for 1 year, 4 months, and 4 days, even though every witness testified it always remained essential to the efficiency of the service, they did not repost it until the day that they found out Ms. Potter was resigning. On March 9, 2017, once they discovered that she was leaving the agency, they hastily moved forward to process that position and have it filled for recruitment. That is in-your-face blatant retaliation, and it shows that the agency was retaliating against my client because they did not want her to have that position due to her whistleblower activities. And we believe that that should be considered in the totality of the circumstances analysis of Ms. Potter's involuntary resignation. And Guzman states that a series of events of a multiple of over a series of time can be considered when a contributing factor test is considered. So even if you believe that Ms. Nelson was the personnel manager that was in control of putting her on a classified detail, you still can consider the events prior to Ms. Nelson coming to the agency to make a determination if the involuntary resignation included events prior to that time, which was the August 8th disclosure to the OIG, the August 20th cooperation with the investigation, including the July 10th email. Dr. Smith was at the agency that entire time, and she was the individual that put Ms. Potter on the unclassified duties. The testimony states that. Ms. Nelson simply says that she signed the document. She said that Dr. Smith and Mr. Baranski were the individuals that were responsible for the unclassified duties detail. And it doesn't, and even the respondent doesn't actually give explanation on why there was an unclassified detail. They simply state that they wanted Ms. Potter to replace Dr. Duarte in the morning report. That's only one position, not the other three positions that she was asked to do. It is our argument that they placed those other three positions upon her to make her life so difficult at the agency that she was forced to leave. And that's why it should be considered as involuntary resignation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We thank both sides. The case is submitted. That concludes our proceeding for this morning.
All right.